Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison and to our listeners on WIDELP Low Power Radio in Madison. We have a panel of three today discussing the November debate between Tony Blair and Christopher Hitchens in Toronto. And our panel is Ken Haydock, Dalita Shapiro, and Frank Power, and they'll be presenting their comments in that order. So I'll let Ken start off.
First, I've been asked by my fellow panelists to mention that we're not going to be touching on the stand that Blair and Hitchens took with respect to the Iraq War. That would be a three-hour discussion for starters in and of itself, so we'll ignore that. I'm going to start out, and I'm going to try to keep my remarks as brief, talking about the nature of this encounter between Blair and Hitchens, and then Dalita and Frank will get more into the actual substance of what they were talking about, what each said. What struck me on reading, I guess about the first 80% of the debate, and then watching the remaining 20% on the internet where it was available, was what I considered an anomaly. Now, I happen to have been half a century ago on 1 year only on my high school debating team. And this encounter was not billed as a conversation, a discussion, parallel lectures, or an exposition of ideas. It was billed as being a debate. And it was structured that way. It's what's known technically as an Oxford-style debate. And in an Oxford-style debate, a vote is taken before and after, and we see how much of the audience may have been swayed. The debate style or debate styles more common in the U.S. involve a judge who rates the folks on a point system. And if I had been the judge for this particular debate, I wouldn't have given either of the participants really high grades for the following reason. In the title of the debate topic, the words religion and good appear. At no point did either participant directly define what he meant by those terms. This is unheard of in debating. I mean, this doesn't happen. Blair did, by indirection and repetition over time, provide a definition for what he meant by religion, which I infer to be modern, tolerant, mainstream Christianity, similar to his views and those of folks that he generally agrees with. At no point did Hitchens challenge him on that. That surprised me. If I were giving points to Hitchens, I might give him more like 6 points. And I don't even remember how the scale on which these things were debated. But again, just looking at the basic structure, I'd give him about 6 points, which isn't a great score. I thought he did a better job than Blair, but what he had done in the course of the debate, without ever defining what he meant by religion, the two of them both seemed to, by default, agree that good somehow has to do with happiness and health and longevity and that sort of thing, but they didn't define it at any point that I spotted. Hitchens kind of, in the course of the debate, establishes a whole bunch of little bricks, which he assembles into an argument or a wall, if you will, toward the end. He gives examples of how folks motivated by religion have done bad things over time. And only in the conclusion does he basically create a really interesting argument, and one that kind of cuts the foundation out from much of what Blair had been saying, in which he pointed out, directly addressing Blair, that both of them were longtime members of the Labour Party in Britain. Labour Party members refer to themselves as socialists. He said, as socialists, we have spent a lifetime, each of us, opposing communism. Blair gives a few examples of how, hey, there have been some communists who have done some good things that we would agree on. These are good things. But, he concludes, the costs of communism, he seems to be referring to the doctrinaire Soviet Marxism, far outweigh the benefits, likewise in Hitchens' view, religion. So I think he does salvage an argument that basically Blair didn't answer. I saw Blair as constantly conceding ground. Oh, yeah, you don't need to be religious to do good, but a lot of good is done by people motivated by religion. So my observation here relates to the fact that this is a debate, and I didn't think that as a debate, either of the participants did a really swell job in establishing its parameters and sticking within those parameters in a clear way. That's what I brought to the party. I now defer in terms of the substance to Delita and Frank.
Well, I'm going to repeat a little bit of what Ken said, in that Blair and Hitchens both acknowledge that religion, however it's defined, can be a force for good in the world, which was the topic of debate. To Hitchens, religion's destructive forces as a direct consequence of scriptural authority far outweigh the good, and the world would be better off without religion. And his referral to scripture authority, I think, was a major, major issue with Hitchens. To Blair, again, repeating, Ken, faith in God inspires believers to do good in the name of religion, and that people of faith should work together to minimize the destructive forces of religion. I found Hitchens straightforward about his opinion of people of faith. I mean, everything Hitchens says is right in front of you. He declares religious people won't be happy until you believe as they do, because that's what their holy books tell them. I can't generalize that to every religious person, but I think there certainly is a goodly number of people in which that's the case. Hitchens finds that, and I quote, a threat to the idea of a peaceable community and the underlying energy that powers the friendly disagreement between Tony and myself, referring to the scriptural authority. So that, he finds, is his basic disagreement with Blair. Blair believes destructive forces are a diversion of faith. He repeats and repeats and repeats the notion that people of faith should work together to bridge differences and to be inspired by their faith to do good. This is the thrust of his Tony Blair Faith Foundation, which aims to promote respect and understanding about the world's major religions and show how faith is a powerful force for good in the modern world. The website keeps changing. It's kind of interesting to see how he's... it evolves. Blair respectfully refers to Hitchens as his friend. He says secularists can be compassionate. He says people of faith should welcome challenges by secularists. His foundation website cites an atheist humanist who was hugely impressed by Tony Blair's constructive, positive vision for interfaith cooperation as a necessity for addressing global conflict in the 21st century. So he is quoting an atheist humanist on his own website. The site mentions inclusion of non-believers, but the primary focus is on uniting major religions. Blair gave two speeches in 2009, which indicate either a darker opinion of secularists or a most unfortunate choice of words. And I think they are worth touching on and relating to this debate. His 2009 speech at Georgetown University's Conference on Muslim and Christian Understanding seems to have disappeared online. I can't find it, and links aren't leading me to it. It may still be there somewhere. According to reviewers, including Jonathan Turley and Austin Klein, Blair stated that those who scorn God and those who do violence in God's name both represent views of religion, but both offer no hope for faith in the 21st century. Blair warned that we face an aggressive secular attack from without. We face the threat of extremism from within. Arguing that there was no hope from atheists who scorn God, Blair said the best way to confront the secularist agenda was for all faiths to unite against it. Now, I'm bringing this up because this is what Blair did not say in his debate with Hitchens. An atheist writer, Austin Kline's take on this is that Blair is setting up secularists as a common enemy in order to increase his base. Blair supporters on the blogosphere are really upset with that, and they claim that was not at all Blair's intent, that he was talking about people who were extreme in their opposition to God's belief. Blair's earlier speech at the 2009 National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., made it clear that his wording at Georgetown was not a one-time bad choice of words, as some people assert. Blair's first, he first expressed his concern about an attack on religion from within due to exclusionary behavior. And with that, I can concur, and I'm sure Hitchens would as well. Then Blair says this, from without, religious faith is assailed by an increasingly aggressive secularism which derides faith as contrary to reason and defines faith by conflict. I think that rather well describes his friend Hitchens. Blair goes on to say, thus do the extreme believers and the aggressive non-believers come together in an unholy alliance. Blair does not, and I quote him here, decry the work of humanists who give gladly of themselves for others and who can often shame the avowedly religious because of their good work. He also says, those who do God's work are God's people. I only say that there are limits to humanism. This, I'm still quoting Blair. There are limits to humanism, and beyond those limits, God and only God can work. Now, this was at the prayer breakfast, and needless to say, the organizers did not invite Hitchens to respond.
I should think not.
The annual National Prayer Breakfast is a series of relationship-building events organized by the Fellowship, also known as the Family, and sponsored by members of Congress. President Obama attended the one in 2009 where Hitchens spoke, and Obama himself spoke in 2010 and 2011. The 2011 breakfast was picketed by gay rights organizations for the family's alleged support of proposed legislation in Uganda that calls for imprisonment or execution of homosexuals. Now, I'm not by any means implying that Tony Blair is involved in this, but I am troubled by his keynoting that breakfast and by the Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and other U.S. officials deeming the family important enough to give it government sanction by attending its annual events. And I wish Hitchens had had an opportunity to comment on that. The family is a secretive, power-seeking, theocratic organization that has influence worldwide. I've been reading about it since Jeff Charlotte outed it in 1993 in a Harper's magazine. Today's discussion is not about that organization, but I think it's worth a mention. And I recommend Charlotte's in-depth history and commentary in his book titled The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. So again, I'm not accusing any of, whether it's Obama or Blair, of taking to heart everything the family does, but the fact that they show up there is a problem for me, and I wish that it had that had been addressed somehow in this debate. As for the debate topic, I personally believe that good in the world would be enhanced by cooperation without coercion between compassionate secularists and non-proselytizing religious people of many faiths. I happen to personally be giving money to a religious organization that is probably keeping a child perhaps from dying in Haiti. Is giving him schooling, is giving him clothing, is giving him a backpack, is giving 2 meals a day. I don't agree with everything they do, but I'm glad that they're doing what they do. So I kind of hit my feet in both camps in this regard. So Frank Power now has our panel's final say.
Well, I think that Blair made it quite clear that man is a religious animal. In the earliest recording of human history, man has been religious. And even in very primitive religion, man had a fear of other human beings who had passed away, and much of primitive religion has to do with that. I tried this week to look at how many times religion showed up in the front page of this paper here. I would say if an alien arrived right now from someplace, he would say that in Wisconsin, Green Bay Packers is the religion. There's also a story of a Janesville man who was buried for 4 hours in the snow the other day, 66. He went out to pick up his mail, and somehow he slipped on the ice. And Sidell and I were actually going to the health club, and we saw a woman fall down, and she couldn't get up either. And while he couldn't get up because it was so slippery, the snowplow came along and plowed him under. And he was under for 4 hours. Fortunately, he survived. But the point that I'm making is, this is a quote, he says, "I was wondering if it was the end of my life and maybe I'll see God." So I think that in terms of the debate, I agree with Ken that they should have defined the terms more, you know. But nonetheless, if you look around at Catholic hospitals, at Catholic schools, at Catholic universities, if you look around at all the missionary work, I myself was a missionary for many years in education abroad, most people are religious. They've been religious since the beginning of time. It has to do with meaning and purpose and so on. And this debate was basically about the great struggle right now between religion and science. Religion is basically about the sacred, about the supernatural, about God seekers, as John Huston, the great English historian of religion, calls it, people seeking God. And it's caught up in evolution when now even people like Hitchens and others are becoming much more vitriolic in the sense that when people deny evolution, they really are attacking science. So that's part of the reason, I think, behind what Tony Blair would be talking about, that religion is under attack mm-hmm. by secularists. And if you read them, they're basically saying, yes, science is under attack by people that do not accept evolution and would try to either remove evolution from the classroom or to substitute evolution for creationism or make them equal or whatever. And so Sidell and I just looked at a film the other night and it was all about this big struggle now between science and religion over evolution. And I think that's one of the big things. I would basically agree wholeheartedly with Tony Blair, however, in the sense that man is religious. There are billions of people that see Jerusalem and the Abrahamic faiths as their way to salvation. They're going to live out their lives that way. And Tony Blair is trying through his Faith Foundation to save wealth, as he would say, for the love of God, let's try to get these people talking to each other so they stop killing each other. Mm-hmm. Hitchens, on the other hand, says it ain't gonna happen because basically God gave them land, and as long as God gave them land and they think each exclusively that that's their land, and in the Holy Land, and we know about the Crusades, and we know about the battles for the Holy Land and the Palestinians and so on. Hitchens says it ain't going to happen because religious authority stands on the fact that they have the final say because they have the direct line to God. So you have this debate in terms of Tony Blair, but at least I think Tony Blair, being a diplomat, being a realist, trying to bring these people together to try at least to reduce the killing, to try to make some kind of sensible thing about the land and making peace. So if you ask me in terms of, you know, the debate, I think that religion does do good, and a man of faith like Tony Blair and his Faith Foundation is seeking to do good in the real world. Though I have to agree that religion is receding, it's fighting a losing battle by the march of science, and Hitchens is in your face as some of the other evolutionaries, scientists are, particularly at this time. I just want to say one thing about Viktor Frankl, who I happen to believe is, if I have a Bible next to my bed, it's like Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who's a Holocaust survivor, who basically is struggling or struggled to find something in the modern world that could keep man positive and life-affirming despite the Holocaust. Even in the Holocaust, he was a Holocaust survivor. And he basically says that if man has a purpose, then he can put up with anything. If man has an affirmation of life, then he can endure any suffering. And much of religion is about how do you deal with suffering, how do you deal with death, is there an afterlife, and so on. Even though Frankl didn't really believe that, he believed that somehow religion or the search for meaning is the key. And if you can find meaning, and I see that up on the wall here, we believe in a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. So in many respects, it's about meaning. And so trying to find peace in the Middle East, I think is a noble experiment, a noble vision, trying to attack the people that would deny evolution, I think, also gives meaning to people like Hitchens.
I have a question. Tony Blair, after leaving office as Prime Minister, converted to Roman Catholicism. Did that come up during the debate?
Yes, I think it did.
There was a passing reference to it. It didn't get into detail. Blair's wife, I believe, has been a lifelong Catholic, and as Prime Minister of Britain, you preside over a country that is Anglican, so there may have been a political element there, although a quick note is a fun footnote. The hereditary master of ceremonies for all coronations comes from a family that didn't join the Anglicans and remains Catholic to this day, and that a coronation ceremony is basically an enhanced form of Anglican communion.
It's interesting that Hitchens, in the debate, in the very beginning of the debate, criticized John Henry Cardinal Newman, who was an Episcopal churchman who converted to Catholicism. And in his book, Apologia Pro Vita Sua, he said that he made some kind of moral universal statement that Hitchens found completely outlandish and used that. The Catholicism argument or the conversion to Catholicism actually is very hot in, I think, in England right now, and it might have been part of this debate, unspoken, because John Henry Cardinal Newman is up for beatification, which is one of the steps towards sainthood. So I think that Hitchens, in his own way, I've heard Hitchens debate and completely, he was actually fairly easy, I think, on Tony Blair. If you've seen Hitchens in his reel, we saw, Siddell and I saw him absolutely take a brilliant rabbi and just chew him up and spit him out at the 92nd Street Y a couple of years ago.
This was not classic Hitchens. He was clearly on his best behavior and was very, very gracious. There was no particular vitriol in certainly anything he said that was directed to Blair.
Yes.
It's also perhaps of note that Hitchens, who currently is undergoing chemotherapy, appeared bald. He didn't look like the Hitchens on the back of book jackets. The vigor of his intellect was there, but he was quite mild mannered compared to what I've seen of him in the past.
Yes.
Are there any presidents who have not attended the prayer breakfasts?
No.
The prayer breakfast started under Eisenhower. One version of what happened, as I understand it, was Eisenhower didn't really want to go, but he didn't see how he could avoid it. But they do not date back to George Washington or something like that. In the rhetoric that surrounds them, you might be led to believe that, but they don't go back much further than the 1950s.
Presidents are politicians, and America is a religious country. There is only one avowed atheist in the Congress. That's
right.
Sparks, I believe.
Stark in California.
And the prayer breakfasts are more than just a breakfast.
The
national prayer breakfast is, there are a number of other events that take place at the same time. And then throughout, not only the country, but throughout the world, there are prayer breakfasts that are held on other levels, state levels, local levels.
But it's national in the way Federal Express is federal. It's not an assigned national.
It's not the
National Day of Prayer either.
No, it's not a government.
If this was run by the Scientologists, no one would show up. Seriously.
Yeah.
This was actually put on the White House website, the fact that they were going to be at this prayer breakfast. And this is, everybody here should be writing to their whatever and protesting this, because it's absolutely unbelievable that our politicians are a secular society. I don't care if it's going to mean Obama gets elected because he went and spouted about his Christian faith.
They get about 300,000 or about 3,000 people, I think. I don't know what the current attendance was. I think they get around 3,000 people, and some come from many countries, other heads of states from other countries. And then they also use it as, in some ways, and I don't know the specifics, but they use it as a recruitment tool. According to Jeff Charlotte, the group is very much into power, is not into, and I think the concern is power and basically a religious state, a religious world.
They have a very bizarre world government. Christian understanding. They think they're above religion. You've probably heard about the affairs that certain congressmen, John Ensign from Nevada, Sanford from South Carolina, they all were living at C Street House, paying very little rent. They were basically subsidized. The building itself, C Street House, was called a church, and it was actually off the tax rolls for the city of Washington, D.C., which has been corrected. And they basically had their mistresses staying right there with them, because they think if you're powerful, the Bible does not apply to you. They're a very weird sect. You can read about them on Wikipedia. It goes all the way back to the 1930s. These people actually think Hitler and was that his form of government and what he did, they actually think he was brilliant. I mean, this is just bizarre that all of these political leaders attend this. I know this is off topic for the Hitchens debate. I mean, they had Mother Teresa speaking there. You know how much Hitchens loves her.
This week, one of the most striking things I saw in the paper was in the square in Egypt when they're throwing rocks. One group was over here throwing rocks, another group was over here, and in the middle were all these people at prayer. And prayer is a fundamental part of the Muslim world, and to me, that was a very, very striking picture. And I said to myself, anyway, in the sense of today, you know, score one for Blair, in the sense of faith.
Two quick things on that. Is that apparently at one point the Coptic Christians formed a human chain around the Muslims at prayer to protect them from intrusion by those who were not involved, which is if perhaps a little bit of silver lining in a dark cloud. And getting back to the point earlier about how old and venerable the prayer breakfast is, just briefly, I'm reminded that I sat in on a first day of classes once with a friend at Yale, and the professor told everybody there, he said, well, there's this meeting that the department is sponsoring that I'd like you all to attend. He said, it's an old Yale tradition. Then he paused and he said, well, it isn't. We've only been doing it for a few years, but he said, if you do anything on a campus for more than 4 years, who knows that it isn't an old Yale tradition? And I think that there's a large element to that, and a lot of the things that are going on in terms of religious activities and political activities, for that matter, where people are rewriting our history. Our Pledge of Allegiance was originated without reference to God by a socialist, thank you, in the late 1800s. Our national anthem wasn't our national anthem formally until, I believe, the 1930s. But you'd never know that listening to some of these people. And so it's important sometimes to ask the question about things that are being asserted as if they're an inherent and integral part of Americanism.
Our money is not be trusted until 1953.
That's right.
Also, the sort of tone. I mean, I like the fact that Freedom from Religion points this out. When Kennedy was running for president, and when he became president, the various religions were so concerned about him being a Catholic that that he really had to stand up and say that he believes in the absolute separation of church and state. Now we have a president who thinks it's a good idea to go all National Family on the Council Christian and appeal the vote on the National Day of Prayer. It's a definite change of tone between religions. And then it was more religions keeping each other separate from the government. Now it's almost completely the opposite, you know. And I said to a friend of mine, and I think it helped him become at least an agnostic, that if religion didn't corrupt government and government didn't corrupt religion, I'd love them to hang out together, but it seems to me every time they cross paths, they corrupt each other, and it's not at all healthy. And I don't think it's healthy for this government to
That was one of the things I felt that with Blair in the debate was that he totally believes in keeping religion and government together. I mean, he's just like, you know, he thinks that that's just a really good coalition to have, whereas, you know, I think that's just...
Well, he's also from a country where there's an established religion that set out at a time when you know, Unitarian Universalism didn't resemble what it does today, for that matter, set out to allow people, some of whom believed in Protestant theology and some of whom believed in traditional Catholic theology, to sit side by side in the pews and all somehow accept that. I mean, there was an intentional pulling back under the first Queen Elizabeth. As to how dogma is imposed. And this is a country also where the oath of loyalty to the established church was eventually abolished, this enabled a leader of the Jewish community to become a member of the House of Lords, among other things.
Well, the Jesus came out and said that you didn't have to be Christian to do good. She didn't say atheist, but she said that you didn't have to be religious to do good.
Blair made a point during the debate, however, when he was asked about his religion and his decision-making, and it was particularly related to the war, and the Iraq War, and he said that his decision with regarding the Iraq War had to do with the information at hand, and that it was not based on his religion. I mean, he tried very hard, according to Blair, to really make decisions based on what he thought was the most sensible thing to do at the time. And
at that point, he wasn't a Catholic.
That's true.
I thought the Catholic Church is letting Anglicans join Anglican ministers, whatever they're
called, priests,
because they're so opposed to women becoming ordained, and they're going to make a little subset just for the Anglicans.
Well, actually, I believe there already were historically some churches that were in communion with their meaning accepted by the Roman Catholic Church, where priestly celibacy wasn't a requirement already.
That Philippines, you could be married and be a Catholic priest.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I think it has. Well, I certainly think that it's legitimate to say that in part relates to a certain level of misogyny. It also relates to a lack of recruitment, just in sheer numbers, without reference to paternalism.
I thought that was a high point for Hitchens when they were talking about his comments about women. I mean, that's why he's just so adamantly opposed to Mother Teresa, who basically her goal was to keep women reproducing endlessly, you know, and that was. I mean, if you want to lift up society, you lift up women and you will, you know, society. And that means not just having 300 children or whatever. And he's always been a champion for women as opposed to the church, which is, you know, you're just subservient no matter where you are in most churches.
Are we still talking about Hitchens? Okay,
go ahead.
I haven't, you know, heard it, but can we talk about things beyond that, just in our own, about our own attitudes towards this?
Sure, sure. Okay. Why not?
There are two things that I always find interesting. Right now, I just read in one of my German things from the internet, is that the German language, a large group of the German language Catholics, that means Swiss, Austrians, and Germans, have made very serious, or are making very serious efforts of approaching the Catholic regime to do away with the celibate and to let women become ministers and so forth. And it's in the process of raising quite a ruckus. The interesting thing to me is this whole connection between politics and religion really sit in Europe. I don't remember my history that well, but 14th or 15th century, where with that very, very famous dictum whose origin I forgot, and it's cuius regio, eius religio. That was the rule, whoever is the ruler, who is the one who determines my religion. And this was the Europe-wide law. I think it was the 15th century, whoever one of the rulers was. And historians, or let's say students, never go back that far in history. And I've hardly ever heard somebody in this country mention that as the root of the close connection between religion and politics.
I think it goes back even earlier in history.
Even earlier, what, 13?
No, I think throughout history. There is a group in Russia, in the Caucasus, who are Slavic, and fair-skinned, light-haired, light eyes, who have been for centuries Jewish. Apparently there was a potentate there who noticed that one of the hostile armies was all Christian, another was all Muslim. Here's a perfectly good religion that's been around for centuries. We're gonna join that. And that was how it was selected. It's sometimes hard for Americans to forget that going back a century ago, pretty much everybody in Denmark looked like everybody else in Denmark and was Lutheran. Even though the real basis, I would argue, of the troubles in Northern Ireland was socioeconomic and political, the labels certainly that made it to this side of the Atlantic were all religious labels, and that wasn't an anomaly. That's the way history unfolded. If you tell me someone's religion at any point in Europe in the 1500s on, I can tell you that that person's religion, or that person is an outcast, one or the other.
The 30 years war that devastated most of Europe was based supposedly on religion, but of course the rulers, the kings and emperors at that time, were talking religion, but they really meant land and power and so forth. So it's not this is an old tradition, and it's probably something that's sort of subconsciously still in people's minds. Without here, this being an immigrant nation, they're not even aware of this. And the other question that is always in my mind when I come to a discussion like this, and I'm glad I came, I wanted to come out from under my snow. The first question comes to mind: is religion a force of good? Good, I would have to say. What religion specifically? There is no one religion.
This relates to my point.
This point.
It has to be specified whose religion, where, and when, and what.
Exactly. It's important to define it in part temporally, what point in time, and geographically.
Absolutely.
And even there, we could go to Nevada. And people would argue as to whether Mormonism is part of Christianity or not. Different folks who, if you say that Roman Catholics and Greek and Russian Orthodox clearly are Christian, the further you get away from them in terms of the foundation of other Christian sects, more likely it is that someone's going to say, wait a minute, you're not Christian, you don't believe X, Y, and Z, and that's fundamental. That's core. The term applies to Quakers. Quakers and Catholics share very little in terms of ritual, certainly, and dogma, certainly. There's no creed for them. But yeah, it's highly critical. And what Blair did from a debating standpoint is he just avoided all that, and by implication, allowed religion to be nice 21st century people who want peace. Not fair. That's not good.
I would just like to say, as my final remark, in that sense, the saying of the wonderful Mahatma Gandhi.
Oh yeah.
There are as many religions as there are individuals.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's another question over here. Did you have a question?
Oh, I just wondered where the concept of free will came into the discussion. Or if it was ever discussed, which would break away from the question of religiosity. Was free will discussed as an evil or a plot against God's will?
And I think there was a reference to it by Hitchens, a favorable reference. Certainly one of his points in context was that you surrender your free will if you turn it over to an organized religion.
Well, isn't that part of most organized religion, is that we do have free will?
There's a real distinction between, particularly, let's say, when you get into evangelical versus fundamentalist, et cetera, and I'm not going to try to pick which is which, but there is definitely a distinction between those that think that, the absolutists and the people who believe that within the framework of their religion that you have choices to make.
It also depends who's defining the term. I believe that I might not only be able to paraphrase it, but there's a quotation engraved on the facade of the building where the Episcopal Church in the U.S. has its headquarters in New York. I'm certain it's biblical, but I can't pinpoint where for you, which is obedience to God is perfect freedom, or something like that. So if you accept Eric Blair, which is to say George Orwell's definition of doublethink, who's doing the defining is very, very important.
Did you want to say something a while ago? I think you had your hand.
It's gone. What were the two things you said that the Germans want? They want the priests to be able to marry?
It's a group that is very strongly urging the present Catholic regime to do away with celibate, to let women become ministers, and to open up just sort of like...
Didn't Martin Luther do that?
No, not Martin Luther.
Yeah. I mean, I tell that to a lot of my Catholic friends that was like, you know, well, we want to be able to do this. And I said, well, then you want to be a Lutheran, because the Lutherans were Catholics, and that's what Martin Luther did. He wanted priests to be able to be married. He wanted the Bible to be in English and the service to be in English.
Well, he didn't want the Bible to be in English. He translated the Bible from...
Well, into the language, not English.
Into the vernacular.
He put it into the language of the day.
The language of the people. And he himself was married.
He married.
But I mean, his first fight was against the monetary corruptness of the Catholic Church that sold forgiveness for their sins, you know.
Well, you know why priests are celibate, don't you?
What?
You know why priests are celibate.
That's a joke now. Why?
No. It's because priests used to be married, but they also had families to support.
The cost.
They wanted to leave a legacy to those families, and so the church decided there was too much commingling of money, and overnight they decided that priests could not be married, and often priests' families starved to death.
I just know that there are a lot.
It's not because of Paul and the Bible and Jesus wasn't. There's no biblical reason. The church made rules up based on what they wanted. You want to increase the numbers of the church's, members? No birth control.
We do need to be careful with respect to Martin Luther and English, and not fall into the trap that a local Texas politician fell into like 30 years ago, something like that, where she, I believe it was, in defending English as the language for the country, said if it was good enough for Jesus of Nazareth, it's good enough for us.
Oh, that's cool. That's the other thing people don't realize when they're reading, especially, King James Version, is that all of these thems and thous were not the way the Bible was originally written anyway.
True.
Did you have something to say over here?
I was just going to add about religion and government. In the Western world, in the 300s, the Emperor Constantine used new Christianity to unite his empire, and that's why we have things like Christmas and Easter. You know, it was the old Roman Saturnalia, it was Christmas. Easter were the spring fertility rites. That's why, that's how all that came to be. Mm-hmm.
Well,
it goes way back.
Yeah, I think
although the Christmas celebration started much later in the European country, like the Christmas tree, they didn't have it that early.
Right.
Much, much later.
Let the sense of the meeting thank Germany for the Christmas tree. We appreciate that.
I wouldn't even
go. The Puritans didn't allow you to celebrate Christmas because they considered it a pagan holiday.
Well, yeah.
Christmas wasn't even celebrated.
It was.
We didn't even have Christmas trees in this country until the late 1800s, I think it was.
Yeah.
Late 1800s, maybe.
And in Germany, it really got to be big during the First World War. And that was kind of a propaganda by the emperor, by the Kaiser, to send little Christmas trees into the trenches so that the soldiers could celebrate in the same way as the emperor's, the Kaiser's family, with having some nice...
Except for the part about the trenches.
Oh, of course. But, it was very successful. It was a very successful publicity stunt.
I would just like to add one thing about the whole controversy between... science and religion. Plato is going to have a course in the fall of this year based on this book called Adams and Eden.
Oh, good.
And,
good title.
And we serve on the one of the curriculum committees of Plato, and the syllabus looks really wonderful. So I bought this book, Steve Paulson. I think he's a Wisconsinite.
Yes.
Steve Paulson. And I didn't know him, but getting to know him. And he interviews all of the leading folks in a very effective way. And then that course can be based on this book in the fall.
That sounds interesting. Is it in the fall, you said?
In the fall, yes. Okay. So.
Yeah, I heard he was going to do that.
Any other questions about the debate, Warren?
Not about the debate, about this discussion. I think a good humanist slogan is, nothing human is alien to me. And I get that from Max Weber, but I'm sure somebody else said it before that. And that means nothing about religion is alien to me, and it's sort of fun to look at the great variety of religious beliefs and practices. And if you can maintain a little distance, you can sort of treat it as maybe a matter of wit or getting a variety of perspectives about the human condition. And
for some distance and good reading, read Thomas Paine's book on the Bible. He is my hero. What's the title of it? I forgot. But he
the
wrote
Age of Reason.
The Age of Reason by Tom Paine. I mean, he was British, but and the Americans almost did him in when he died. They forced a priest or some pastor into his room when he was on his deathbed, and he was trying to keep these people out, but he was too sick and near death to be successful. So, but that's really a book for me.
I find it fascinating, the varieties in religion. I think I draw the line when someone wants to take over my country and turn it into a religious state.
Oh, God, yes.
Or tell me how to believe.
I think it's even more insidious than that. In Wisconsin, our stem cell research program at the University of Wisconsin is basically being destroyed by a lawsuit put on by Christians who want to be able to adopt these embryos. And the fact that you cannot use an 8-cell blastocyst or whatever, they're less than 100 cells, a blastocyst for research that can save hundreds of lives, cure cancer, help. I mean, if you're opposed to that, it's like abortion. If you don't like abortion, don't have one. I mean, abortion is another legal right that is completely and totally under attack by the fundamentalists in this country, to the point that they're willing to kill off the suppliers of abortions by killing the doctors. And I think that, this is where, New Mexico, there's a state senator in New Mexico that wants to bring creationism back into the science textbooks.
Well, much longer. Texas, I think.
Yeah, and Texas creates all of the textbooks for all of us. I'm not sure how that ever got going.
Basically, we have the greatest number of
Christians, don't they?
No, the greatest number of textbooks needed is in Texas, so they go with what Texas needs.
And again, I would not throw all the Christians into this sort of thing,
because
it's really a very vocal, fairly minority. Because when I lived in Germany in the 80s, for example, I was in very heavy political activity with the left wing of the Lutheran Church. Mm-hmm. In fact, we demonstrated at the American Embassy when the Americans under Reagan, sent planes over and bombed. Was it
Iraq?
Algeria.
Nay,
it wasn't Algeria. It was Syria.
Lebanon.
It's one of those Middle Eastern countries, and the big propaganda in Germany was, of course, that they killed one of the children of the ruler. Who is that?
Libya.
Libya.
Gaddafi's
children.
Yeah. That's true. That's it. So, and those were Lutheran pastors and Lutherans, and then a bunch of us Americans living there, and this was a Christian group.
I guess, when you look at history, the civil rights movement, and there were a lot of religious people involved in that, Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
At the same time, there were, like, for women's suffrage, that was very, very opposed by the church for women to be able to have the right to vote.
Sure.
The ministers would ride horseback through the parades of women and knock them down. And, I mean, giving up the biblical right of men to be the head of the household was, you know,
but those are just
examples
of the impossibility of
making
a sweeping statement about almost anything.
True enough.
So,
if anybody wants to look at something quite interesting, though, if you can get online, the History Channel has, it's called The Lost Books of the Bible, which is very eye-opening.
Mm.
When they had the Council of Nicaea, they picked the books of the Bible that they were going to include, and then they left a lot of them out. And if you watch some of this stuff about how Adam and Eve basically lived, and there's a book called The Book of Jubilee, which is about ghosts and goblins, and it's a very, you see how completely manipulated the Bible was. Everybody thinks this is the Word of God, and it was just made up by a bunch of people.
Sure.
And they also talk about how the pagans and all these different religions all kind of coexisted before that, and then they decided that that's why they had to have one combined, effort. So that's kind of how everything got kind of blended into one religion. Christianity became the major religion at that point.
Well, if there are no more comments on the debate, let's thank our panel.
Yes.